morning. My name is Jackie Thompson. I am a counsel at the labor and employment law firm of Fort Harrison. I exclusively represent management in employment litigation, and we are obviously seeing a huge rise in litigation involving sexual harassment in the wake of the Me Too movement. So I'm here today to talk a little bit about the rise of the Me Too movement, how it is affecting employers, and then some tips to work through investigations and to hopefully avoid having these type of claims in the workplace. So starting with the history of Me Too, this really started back in October of 2017 when the New York Times broke the story of Harvey Weinstein, and this really opened up the floodgates of many, many people coming forward and saying that they've experienced similar sort of treatments. And this was spurred by Alyssa Milano, an actress who sent out a tweet indicating that if, you know, all individuals, she said women, but it really meant all individuals who had been either sexually harassed or assaulted wrote, Me Too is a status that would give people a sense of the magnitude of the problem. And she was absolutely right. It was that Me Too hashtag that really did give people a sense of this very widespread problem. It started in the entertainment business, but it's really spread to all employers, all businesses. This is a concern for every single employer. So the history of Me Too, really, it began with Alyssa Milano, and then within, I have numbers here for Twitter and Facebook. This was as of March of 2018, so a couple months ago, and really these numbers have grown since then. But even in just the first, you know, 6 months after the story broke, there were over 1.7 million tweets that included the Me Too hashtag. And on Facebook, there were more than 12 million posts in less than 24 hours by almost 5 million users worldwide. So that's a huge number that really brought to light the vast problem of sexual harassment in the workplace. Many, many individuals have been called out on this type of behavior. A lot of these were very, very famous names. Kevin Spacey, Matt Lauer were two of the biggest names that came to the forefront after Harvey Weinstein, Mario Batali. These people have lost their jobs. They've lost investors in their restaurants. They're really starting to feel the backlash of their actions that they had taken previously with both sexual harassment and, in some cases, sexual assault. And in fact, the LA Times reported that a powerful person has been accused of misconduct at a rate of nearly once every 20 hours since Weinstein. So once a day since then, there has been a powerful person. And this is really just in reflection of in the news and with high level executives. This is not even including all of the people that have come out and accused misconduct in their workplaces that have really not gotten the press that Harvey Weinstein or some of these other celebrities have gotten. So the EEOC released some statistics back in June of 2016. These are a little dated at this point, especially because these did come out in before the Me Too movement. I think these numbers have likely increased since then. But as of June of 2016, 85% of women had reported experiencing sexual harassment in the workplace. And although there's not as many, statistics that involve men, there was a study of federal employees, of male federal employees, who indicated that 15% of them had some sort of unwanted sexual attention or sexual coercion at work. And I suspect that that number is actually a little higher because men tend to be a little bit more reluctant about reporting this even anonymously. And again, it's not just women that are feeling the sexual harassment and sexual misconduct in the workplace. There are also men that have come forward and most notably Christina Garcia, who was a California congresswoman and initially a very vocal supporter of the Me Too movement. She had two separate men on her staff accuse her of inappropriate behavior, and she ended up having to take an immediate unpaid leave of absence in the wake of those allegations. And the accusers are not just women making accusations against men, or men making accusations against women. James Levine is one of the most prominent men who have had men accuse him of sexual conduct. And in the wake of those allegations, he was suspended by the New York Metropolitan Opera. So we're seeing this type of conduct from sort of a vast variety of ways, still predominantly women that are accusing men, but we're also seeing it, like I said, with men accusing women and women accusing women and men accusing men. So this is not just a straight, you know, just only a woman in the workplace issue. It's affecting everybody. So what's interesting is that at the end of 2017, there was a poll that was released that talked about, you know, what actually does constitute harassment? And when asked if an unwanted compliment about your appearance would amount to sexual harassment, only about 38% of adults said it did, while almost half said it did not. I think part of this is because a little unclear as to what an unwanted compliment might be. There's certainly a difference between, oh, you look nice today, which some people might perceive as sexual harassment, but probably the majority of people would not, versus a comment that says, oh, you know, that top really shows off your breast, or things that really are much more overt. And I think in that type of situation, more people would feel like that type of comment tends more to be a sexual harassment type comment. And that same study, 41% of adults said that they thought that if somebody told you a dirty joke, that that could be considered sexual harassment, but almost 44% said it did not. I think that we're seeing a trend where if this same study was conducted maybe a year from now, I think we might get a little bit more saying that dirty jokes are inappropriate in the workforce and can amount to sexual harassment. I think that the statistics are changing. Non-consensual hugging, again, 44% said that that was sexual harassment, but almost 40% of people said it wasn't. And, you know, again, I think that if we were to repeat this study, because this was taken really right after the Me Too movement broke, I think we might see some of these statistics trend a little bit more towards people feeling like this type of conduct really would constitute sexual harassment, especially in the workplace. So in the fiscal year 2017, these are the most recent statistics that the EEOC has released. They had approximately 27,000 charges alleging harassment, and about 45% of those were specific to sexual harassment. Interestingly, men filed 16.5% of those. The EEOC recently released a statement earlier this month indicating that they've not really seen an increase in the number of charges, but as I'll discuss a little later, we are seeing a difference in the EEOC prosecuting these type of cases. And in 2016, they secured $164.5 million for alleged harassment in the workplace. Now, this is both at the settlement or conciliation stage at the agency, as well as litigation that the EEOC took forward. But those are obviously very large numbers, and employers are definitely being held responsible for this type of conduct in the workplace. So, workplace sexual harassment, again, fairly fairly prevalent. Hopefully, we're going to start seeing those numbers start trending down. But women indicate that almost 50% have either been the direct victim of sexual harassment or have witnessed sexual harassment in the workplace. What's interesting is while men say, a much smaller percentage of men say that they've not been the direct victim, a pretty large percentage indicate that they have witnessed it. And I think they didn't really, this Wall Street Journal study didn't get into what the women, what the men have done if they did witness it. But I think traditionally what we've seen is that while people, particularly men, witness it, they really haven't done anything about it. Hopefully that is something that's changing in the workplace going forward. So part of the problem with sexual harassment is while there's a large number of women and workers who indicate that they have been sexually harassed, very few people are actually reporting the harassment. The last study by the EEOC in 2016 indicated that only about 30% of individuals who experienced harassment will report it to their supervisor, and a much smaller number will actually file formal complaints. And that's generally done when it is sexual harassment that has become pervasive. A lot of it is in response to unwelcome comments. Not as much is actually in response to unwanted physical touching. Only about 8% of that is reported. But I suspect that these numbers have increased again in the wake of the Me Too movement. I think if the EEOC were to report the same sort of study now, we'd probably see higher numbers. And part of the problem on why women have been reluctant to report sexual harassment is that almost half of the individuals or half of the women who indicate that they have not reported it fear that they're just going to be labeled as a troublemaker or they're going to get a bad reputation within the workplace. And that alone prevents them from reporting this type of behavior. Others report that either they feel like it's not going to do any good or that they're going to be retaliated against in some way, while a small percentage also indicate that they feel shame or they feel like they somehow are part of the blame for that conduct. So Time put out their Person of the Year this year, and it was a picture of women that have come forward with allegations of sexual harassment. But you'll note that in this picture, there was a mystery elbow. And so who did this mystery elbow belong to? First glance, you might not even notice it at a cropped out figure at the bottom. But many did notice and speculated about who it might be and why she was cropped from the photo. It turns out that Time magazine explained that she was a hospital worker who chose to remain anonymous. And they felt like it was still important to have her represented, even if she didn't want to have her face on the cover. And her image, basically, according to Time, represented those women who either won't or can't come forward about their sexual assault experiences, and that her presence was an act of solidarity and signified, you know, all those who could not speak out. So the full story reveals that this anonymous woman is a 28-year-old hospital worker from Texas and a mother of two. She had been sexually harassed multiple times by an executive at the hospital where she works. And although she had made several complaints to the human resources department, the behavior hadn't been curbed. So she chose to remain anonymous to protect her and her family's livelihood because she feared the consequences she'd face, interestingly, both at work and within her small town if her identity was revealed. And this is obviously an ongoing problem that hopefully the Me Too movement is starting to encourage women that fear retribution or retaliation to come forward. But it's also something that employers really need to work on by creating a culture for people to come forward and feel safe in that environment if they are experiencing this type of behavior. So why does this matter from an employer standpoint? Well, besides the fact that you want to have a safe workforce for your employees, also very, very expensive. And we've seen some pretty large litigation verdicts in the past couple years on sexual harassment. In the Herring case, this was a case that the employee alleged sexual harassment against a coworker under Title VII, the Civil Rights Act. And she made complaints about sexual harassment and then was terminated shortly thereafter. So she not only had a sexual harassment claim, but also a retaliation claim. So she was awarded a huge number of damages, 300 in compensatory damages, and $1.75 million in punitive damages. She was also awarded an additional $218,000 in attorney's fees. So just huge numbers that are coming out of litigation on these type of allegations. Similarly, Catholic Healthcare West, a federal jury in California, awarded a physician's assistant who alleged she was harassed by surgeons at the hospital, $168 million, which was the largest judgment in U.S. history for a single victim of sexual harassment. Now, that number ended up being vacated and they ended up settling out of court. Obviously, for still a very large number, but these are the type of numbers that I think employers can expect going forward if they are, you know, at trial and the plaintiffs are able to show that not only did they make complaints, but that their employers were not taking those complaints seriously or were not putting corrective actions in place to curb that behavior. 21st Century Fox, $20 million to settle the case of the Fox News allegations, where several women came forward, accused very high level executives within Fox News of sexual harassment. Some additional cases with very high settlement numbers, City of Monroe. In 2017, there were shareholder claims, again, from the sexual harassment scandal at Fox News, $90 million reported settlement. So just huge numbers. Connecticut Health Center, 125. That's just a basic, you know, plaintiff allegation of sexual harassment. And Flushing Medical Center, again, another $15 million. And that one was actually not just harassment, but unwanted touching, which can amount to sexual assault. And we're not just seeing it in healthcare and entertainment. We're also seeing this in the airline industry. We're seeing a lot of complaints about pilots and flight attendants who are, you know, they overnight in various places, they spend a lot of time in hotels. In November of 2016, a SkyWest flight attendant claimed that a pilot drugged and raped her during an overnight. And we've seen several of these type of cases. There's obviously criminal charges associated with that, but the flight attendant also sued SkyWest, saying that the airline was liable because of the pilot's position of authority, both on the flight and within the company, and that they didn't properly address her complaints after she reported the assault. She then claims that she was told that she needed to take time off, and when she did take the time off, that they then unfairly reprimanded her for missing work, although she, you know, said she needed the time to recover from the emotional trauma associated with the attack. So that case is still moving forward. It's in the middle of litigation. But these are the type of cases that we're seeing that go beyond just a Title VII sexual harassment or sexual discrimination type of case. So the EEOC is starting to address this. Like I said earlier, they are not seeing an increase in the amount of charges filed, but they are increasing their litigation associated with those. And just this month, they filed 7 lawsuits for sexual harassment. And the way it works with Title VII type claims is you go to the EEOC, you file an administrative charge, and the EEOC has the option to say either, you know, I feel like this is, you know, we're not going to make a decision one way or the other. We're going to give you a right to sue, and you can go ahead and move forward if you want to do that, you individual. On the other hand, what they can do and what we're seeing here is they can say, not only do we think that you have a good case, but we're going to represent you moving forward. We're going to take your case on personally as an agency and sue your company for the allegations that you've made. And this is, they don't do that a lot, but we're seeing that they are very actively pursuing sexual harassment claims. They did just recently set up a task force on harassment in the workplace. They had a public meeting earlier in June with various witnesses from between lawyers, union representatives, public policy representatives to really hear what is happening in the workforce and try and put together guidelines for employers that the EEOC has indicated they're going to release by the end of the year. Also, just within the last 18 months, over 400 high-profile executives and employees across a wide variety of fields and industries have been outed by the Me Too movement, and a good many of those have lost their jobs as a result. So I mentioned that the EEOC filed these 7 lawsuits earlier this month. This is just an overview, just to give you an idea that it is not specific to any type of industry, and it's not specific to any type of region. We're seeing shipbuilders that are being accused in Alabama. And what's interesting here is this is a lawsuit filed by a male welder at the headquarters. In Santa Barbara, California, there's a staffing agency that's been sued for allegedly allowing a group of female employees to be subjected to sexual harassment while working at the Albuquerque Police Department. In Georgetown, South Carolina, there was a female worker who has accused a coworker of unwelcome physical and verbal sexual harassment. So again, a wide variety of different types of cases, some filed by men, some filed by women, and we're also seeing it in the trucking industry, where in Missouri there was a lawsuit filed for allegedly not preventing sexual harassment. So we're not only seeing it from the perspective of unwanted touching or, you know, going forward with just this is the conduct that was provided, that I endured, but also claiming, look, the company is not putting steps in place to prevent this type of behavior. And the EEOC is looking to that type of behavior from the company and saying, you know, we're going to move forward with these type of cases. Same with the Milk Tea franchise. 2 franchisees were charged with sexual harassment. And then in Cincinnati, cleaning and construction cleanup company are now fighting a lawsuit for an employee that claims that she had a sexually hostile work environment. So there's a lot of different forms that this type of conduct can be seen in litigation. It can be that somebody was sexually harassed, that they feel like they were part of a hostile work environment, or that the company just did not have measures in place to prevent this type of behavior. And I've talked a lot about litigation cost, but there's also soft costs associated with harassment. One of the biggest side effects is turnover. You have very good employees that instead of, making a complaint or making a complaint and feeling like something was done, they just decide to leave the company. And because of that turnover, you can also have decreased productivity.
Certainly, Esquire CLE's first verification code is TREE, T-R-E-E, all lowercase, TREE. Esquire CLE's first verification code is TREE, T-R-E-E, all lowercase, TREE. Please take a moment to write this down.
If it is a matter that gets into the press and you have a PR issue, you can have injury to the reputation of the company. And that can also affect the ability to attract new talent. One of the other side effects of this is individuals that do feel like they've been harassed will often take either sick leave or some sort of PTO to be able to deal with that. And again, that can lead to decreased productivity for the company. And again, I've already talked extensively about litigation. I really haven't even discussed the defense fees part of it. It is very, very expensive to litigate these type of cases. A lot of them do settle pretty early on, but those settlement numbers are very, very large. So it can be very expensive to have these type of claims brought up against a company. So legally, what exactly is sexual harassment? So unwelcome conduct, but what exactly makes conduct unwelcome? In the courts, this is a reasonable person standard, but that can be very difficult because what is a reasonable person can vary from person to person, from workplace to workplace, and court to court. So it's not always clear what this is. But certainly if an individual has said at some point, that conduct makes me uncomfortable, or please, please don't touch me, that makes me uncomfortable, you're then being put on notice as an employer that that conduct is unwelcome. Who can be a harasser? Anybody and everybody. A lot of what's in the news are people in power, so executives, high-level supervisors, but it can also be coworkers, and that's actually frequently where we get this is coworkers. It can be vendors coming in, suppliers. It doesn't have to just be a member of the workforce. It can be people that are coming into the workforce that your employees are exposed to. In the healthcare setting, it can be visitors coming into a hospital, a family member of a patient. So there's a wide variety of different type of harassers that employers need to be aware of. The same goes for who can be a victim. It can be anybody. It can be male or female. It can be same-sex harassment. And it can be, coworkers. So pretty much anybody can be a harasser and anybody can be a victim, which is why it's very important for employers to have policies in place to not only deter this behavior, but to give employees the ability to report this type of behavior. It can also occur anywhere. It doesn't need to just happen at the workplace. So a lot of employers think that, once everybody leaves their office, that they aren't liable for any sort of harassment. But we frequently see that this happens at work-related functions, happy hours, things like that, especially when there's alcohol involved. Or we'll see it in conferences or seminars where employees are not at the workplace, but are staying in hotels and are away from the actual workplace. That can still constitute an area where employers will be liable for harassment. So what is this liability? I've talked a lot about litigation, but how does it actually work? So an employer may be liable for harassing conduct by non-supervisor employees when a member of management knew or should have known that the conduct and failed to take immediate and appropriate corrective action. that's really important that employers understand that even if the employee is not a supervisory employee, if they knew or should have known about the conduct, then they're going to be potentially liable for that conduct. The same is true for a harassing conduct by a non-employee when, again, a member of management knew or should have known of the conduct. So if you have vendors coming in and you are aware that a certain individual has made unwelcome comments or unwelcome touching, and you're aware of that conduct, or you should be aware because it's a small workforce, you see this individual coming in, you see the type of interactions he has with your employees, even though that employee, that vendor is not an employee, you are still liable for that type of conduct. So employers are subject to vicarious liability for unlawful harassment by supervisors. I think that's pretty well known. But they're always liable if a supervisor harassment culminates in a tangible employment action. So what that means is that if you have a supervisor that treats a subordinate differently, specifically because of the sexual harassment and sexual conduct, the employer is automatically liable for that conduct. We are also seeing in a lot of the litigation that's coming up now through the Me Too movement that individual liability of the coworkers or the supervisors. So under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, where a lot of these cases tend to start, there's no individual liability. The only liability that's imputed is to the employer. But there are a lot of state law type torts where not only will the employer be named, but individuals will be named as well. So we're seeing a lot of state law torts that are being tacked on to their Title VII claims where they're accusing the individuals of assault and battery, of negligent hiring for the employer, of retaliation under state laws. Almost every state has an individual anti-discrimination, anti-harassment statute, and many of those are give much broader protections than the federal law. So you need to be aware of that. A lot of them allow for individual liability, and a lot of them will allow these additional state torts to be included in additional to the federal law. Again, driving up the price of litigation, including more people in the litigation, making it very, very difficult to defend. So whether or not to defend that individual as an employer is something that the employer certainly needs to think about when these lawsuits are filed. Claims against the officers and directors can be very, very expensive. This was certainly seen with the 21st Century Fox settlement that I mentioned earlier, where senior officers of 21st Century Fox agreed to a $90 million settlement. And that's because it was not just the company that had to settle it. Those also had litigation that specifically involved both the Fox CEO and Bill O'Reilly. So having these extra individuals added into the litigation certainly drives up the price of litigation and drives up the potential settlement or jury award associated with those. So some companies will decide to do a joint defense between the individual employees that are being sued in an individual capacity as well as the company, whereas some companies will say, all right, you hire your own lawyer, you do what you need to do, we're not going to protect you during this lawsuit. That's a business decision. It is certainly something that's taken on a case-by-case basis and depends a lot on the facts. Certainly if the employee that has been sued has been terminated in the meantime, then likely the company is not going to take on that extra litigation expense or liability. So I've talked a lot about what has happened recently in the past couple of years, specifically in the last 6 or 8 months since the Me Too movement, how we're seeing this being affected through specifically through litigation. But let's talk a little bit about how to prevent this, which is really what employers need to be focusing on. The primary thing is that they need to create a culture where harassment is absolutely unacceptable. And this absolutely starts at the top. You must have buy-in at every single level from the CEO, the board of directors, on down. There has to be a culture of respect for women specifically, but really for all employees. And they need to have very clear expectations of what's not acceptable in the workplace. And you need to hold managers accountable for their behavior and what happens in their area of responsibility. So that means not only are you holding managers accountable for their own behavior, but managers need to be held accountable for the behavior of the employees they manage. So it needs to be a top-down culture shift of this type of sexual harassment conduct is not appropriate in the workplace. And I think nowadays, probably every single employer has a written harassment policy. I strongly encourage everybody, if they've not done so recently, to go back and revisit this policy, have your employment lawyer take a look at it, revise it, really beef it up, make sure that it is, very, very broad, that it covers lots of different types of conduct, and that your employees are very aware of it. But you cannot stop with just having a written policy, because the very best policies can still be undermined, what is actually happening in the workplace. So if you have a great written policy, but you still have employees that, that have a locker room sort of mentality, that are making offensive comments about women, that are stereotyping women's capabilities, that are making sexual jokes in the workplace, allowing pornography, you'd be surprised at how often I get calls from clients all the time that say, "Hey, we just realized that, this employee had pornography in the workplace." That's not, unfortunately, all that unusual. If you have employees that are engaging in some sort of rating of, each other's employees or people that are coming into the workplace, all of that has to be stopped from the top level down. And it's not going to help the employer to just have a written policy if this type of behavior is still going on, because the last thing you want is to be in litigation in a trial in front of a jury and have your defense be, "But we have this written policy." And then you have the plaintiffs bring in five different people that talk about what actually happened in the workplace with this type of behavior. And this is still very commonplace. Hopefully, we're starting to see a decrease of it in the wake of the Me Too movement. People hopefully are starting to curb this type of behavior, but we do still see it. So, auditing your policies and procedures, I mentioned this already. I highly recommend that you take the time now to really review your sexual harassment policies. Make sure that they clearly define sexual harassment. You don't just want a blanket statement of, the company does not condone sexual harassment. You need to include specific examples of unwanted touching, inappropriate conduct. And make sure that not only do you have this policy, but you want it to be user-friendly. You want it to be easy to understand. And you want to make sure that it is not just addressing what is potentially sexual harassment under Title VII, under the federal law, which only currently protects different sex type of harassment. You want to make sure that it also protects same-sex sexual harassment, because while the federal law currently doesn't protect that, that will potentially change at some point. I think the Supreme Court's going to be hearing cases probably in the next year or so that might change that. But as of now, there are actually a lot of state laws that do protect same-sex as a protected class. So just because it's not protected in the federal law, most state laws will. So you want to make sure that your policies and procedures are addressing that. You also want to make sure that you had a very clear no retaliation piece of your sexual harassment policy. You also want to make sure that you have a confidentiality statement in there indicating that anybody that does come in and report will be protected as much as possible. Now, you can't offer full confidentiality because obviously you need to, if you have a report come in, you need to be able to investigate that, which by definition is not going to be fully confidential. But you want to ensure that anybody that is making this type of complaint that is kept as confidential as possible, that only the people that need to know will know about it. You need to have a very clear reporting process in your sexual harassment policy. So you need to indicate that this is the number that you need to call. This is the person you need to call. If you know that if your policy sets forth that the person should first go to their supervisor, which is perfectly fine, you need to give them a second option in case the supervisor is the person that they're going to be making this report against. And then you need to make sure that your policy indicates that there will be a prompt and thorough investigation of all complaints. So, you know, for years, what we would hear from employers is, well, you know, this individual made a complaint, you know, she complained a lot, or it was against somebody that we knew was not, you know, not going to engage in that type of behavior, so we didn't really investigate it. You absolutely need to take seriously any and every complaint that comes through to you and investigate every single one, no matter how minute it might seem. A lot of times what we'd hear too is somebody would come forward and say, this is the conduct that I've been subjected to, but I don't really want to make a full complaint. I don't want you to investigate it. You can no longer actually say, fine, we won't investigate it. If you have an employee that comes forward and makes this type of complaint, it is incumbent upon you to fully investigate it, because the next time that somebody makes a complaint against that potential individual, the company's been put on notice and they're therefore liable for all subsequent conduct that that individual that's being accused might have. So going back to your policy, make sure that it is distributed to all employees. Usually these are part of an employee handbook, so it's given to all new hires. But you know, you should also be periodically having updates with your employees so that they're aware of this policy. A lot of employers have long-term employees, 15, 20 years. When's the last time those individuals looked at the sexual harassment policy? So reissue those now and again, get signed acknowledgement from employees that they're aware of the policy to make sure that everybody is fully aware of not only their personal obligations, but also the company's obligations to deal with this type of behavior. One way to do that is through training, and I think everybody needs to assess their current training policy. A lot of employers use computer-based training, and while this can certainly be sufficient and is generally the most cost-effective way to do training, it's been shown to not necessarily be the most effective. In-person training where people can talk about real life scenarios, can discuss back and forth about what potentially is harassment, what's not, is much more effective than having an employee sit in front of a computer and kind of just click through question after question. Again, this should really not just be for new hires. You want to do this for existing employees too. This is really important for management, especially upper-level management. A lot of employers will really take the time to do sexual harassment training with their sort of mid-level management, their frontline supervisors, but they're not doing it at the higher levels. They're not doing it with their CEO. They're not doing it with the board of directors. They're not doing it with the high-level executives. Basically, because the employers tend to say, well, those people are very busy. Well, those people are also in very high levels of power, and can very much be the harassers. So if the employer is not providing this training to them as well, the employer is going to be liable for really not taking the steps to get things in place to prevent this type of work. And I mentioned earlier that a couple of the most recent cases that the EEOC's put out and filed complaints on are not just solely because somebody claims that they're being sexually harassed, but they're saying, look, you as a company did not take the time or the effort to really put policies in place or procedures in place to prevent this type of conduct. So, you know, again, the best written policy in the world is not going to do you any good if you're not making sure that the individuals that are potentially going to be the harassers are aware of the policy and are being trained on the policy. Also, you want to make sure that you check your state law of where you're located. Some states do require that there's a certain amount of harassment training done every so often. California in particular requires that all employers with 50 or more employees have to provide at least 2 hours of sexual harassment training to each supervisory employee every 2 years. So there's pretty significant fines associated with that if employers are not doing so. So let's talk about the investigation. This is really kind of the key component for sexual harassment reporting, is you really want to make sure that you have conducted a thorough investigation. So even before you have a complaint come forward, employers should have a process. They should know exactly what is going to happen if an employee does come forward. So that means that you should, as an employee, have somebody already designated as the point of contact for conducting these investigations. It might be more than one person, depending on the size of your workforce, but those individuals should be identified, and those individuals should be trained on how to do these types of investigations. When you do get a report in of sexual harassment or inappropriate sexual conduct, absolutely do your homework. Take the time to look at the personnel files and look at the employment histories of all of the individuals involved. Now, oftentimes it's, you know, it's the alleged harasser and the alleged victim. So you have oftentimes a sort of a he said, she said type situation. The employee is going to complain, the alleged harasser is going to deny everything, but you can't stop there. You really need to look at the employment history. Has the alleged harasser had other people file complaints against him or her before? Have there been other indications of, you know, inappropriate conduct or inappropriate touching that the company is aware of? Look through and decide what documents you need. You should absolutely get a statement from everybody involved, a written statement from the complainant, a written statement from the alleged harasser. Also, a written statement from anybody that potentially witnessed this behavior. So certainly, you'll come in, you'll interview the complaining employee. That employee will potentially give names of one or two potential witnesses. Certainly, you want to talk to those potential witnesses. Those are important. But don't stop there, because there may be other employees with knowledge. Now, certainly, you don't want to go out and pull your workforce and say, hey, you know, John had this allegation against him. Have you ever seen him do this type of conduct? But if you have an employee that is claiming that she was pretty consistently harassed and she sits in a cubicle with three other employees, and she says that she's been, you know, a supervisor is coming over and harassing her at her desk, you know, for a certain period of time over months, certainly talk to the other individuals that are within.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is FILE, F-I-L-E, all lowercase, FILE. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is FILE, F-I-L-E, all lowercase, FILE. Please take a moment and write this down.
Earshot and see if they've had any if they've overheard any of that conduct, if they've been subjected to any of that conduct, make sure that you're doing a really thorough investigation. Don't rely solely on the complainant to provide that information to you. So timeliness of investigation. This is important because it's a balancing act. You want to make sure that you are providing an update to the complainant. You want to make sure that you do a fully thorough investigation and not rush through it, but you also don't want to drag it out over weeks or months. So it needs to be completed really as promptly as possible, as long as you're still able to do a thorough investigation. I don't like to set time limitations because it really depends on the workforce. In certain workforces, you might have individuals that are potentially witnesses that are, not easily accessible. Certainly in the airline industry, if you have flight attendants that are on flights in various states, or you might have a nurse that is a potential witness where, she works 3 days on and then 4 days off. So you want to take your time and really do talk to all of the employees that are potentially witnesses, but do so in as prompt of a manner as possible. If you find that your investigation is taking longer than a week, then update the employee that made the report of harassment. Just all you need to say is, look, we've taken your complaints very seriously. We are looking into it. We are fully investigating it. We've not completed our investigation yet, but we'll let you know when we're done. Because just this update is huge to employees. They don't want to feel like they made this report and that they're just being ignored. Certainly, if an employee asks you for a status update, respond to it. If the employee asks you daily for a status update, you're very busy, especially HR professionals that are doing these, have a lot of different things going on, don't ignore that request. Just a simple, we are still investigating it. We're taking this very seriously. We'll get back to you. 2 to 3 sentences is fine, but make sure that that employee feels like they're being heard and feels like their complaint is indeed being investigated. So concluding the investigation, this can be a sort of a difficult thing for employers, because they need to decide based on their investigation, what's the level of appropriate discipline. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the investigation, it's often he said, she said, and so there's no real corroboration of the complaint. That can put the employer in a very difficult position because they don't want to terminate an employee that they have no evidence actually engaged in any sort of harassing conduct. So the punishment should fit the crime. There can be multiple various discipline. Sometimes if it was something that was not maybe pervasive or was just a one-off inappropriate remark, that might call for a written warning or a one-day suspension. Certainly, if you are able to determine that this type of the complaining conduct was pervasive, that it's affected multiple people, that it's been going on for a long period of time, termination might be appropriate at that point. But you should really be consistent in your discipline. That's what's important, is you want to, if you have more than one person that you have dealt with alleged complaints against them, you want to make sure that you're treating them equally and you're essentially disciplining them equally. Once you've decided to take disciplinary action, take it. Don't wait to, kind of go back and forth, decide what to do. You need to make a decision and then sit down with that employee and say, all right, this is the decision we've made. This is the discipline that we're going to give you, and it's effective immediately. So if it's a one-day suspension, the one-day suspension starts the next day. It's important that you are that you're being proactive about engaging in that type of discipline. And make sure that you follow up with the complaining party. Now, you have no obligation to tell the complaining party what the discipline is or what your actual investigation concluded, the facts that you came up with. But what you should say is, we fully investigated your complaint. Thank you so much for bringing it to our attention. And we've taken appropriate corrective action under the circumstances. Even if you don't find a violation, have that employee just sign a copy of your sexual harassment policy and put it in the file. Because what we've seen is, we'll have an employee that made a complaint against another employee. You weren't able to corroborate it. It was he said, she said. 2 months, 3 months go by. Another employee comes and makes the same sort of complaint against that same employee. At that point, you're starting to see a pattern, and you want to have something notated in the file indicating that you've previously had that conversation, that this type of conduct was inappropriate in the workforce, and make sure that you're able to track that and determine if you are seeing any sort of patterns with certain employees. So again, like I said, it's very, very important to communicate the results of the investigation to the complaining party. I think employers traditionally have not been great about taking this final step. They've been good about investigating. They've been good about implementing potential discipline, but they don't close that loop. And an employee, if you don't follow up and say, you know, we thank you again for bringing this to our attention, we fully investigated, we have issued corrective action, or, you know, we found that in this instance that there was, no cooperation, but again, we take your complaint very seriously and thank you so much for bringing it to our attention. Oftentimes, if you don't close that loop, employees think you haven't done anything. So in their mind, you never even investigated it, you never even followed up. Again, you don't need to let them know exactly what the discipline was, but you do need to just, again, let them know that the investigation was done. And oftentimes, it's not really what you say, it's how you say it. It's, you know, being an encouraging workplace, encouraging people to come forward with these types of complaints, letting them know that you take them very seriously. And absolutely make sure that there's no retaliation based on that complaint. And it doesn't hurt too just to follow up with that employee and, you know, a month or so, just check in and say, hey, you know, how are you doing? Have you had any other concerns? That type of follow-up really goes a long way to creating a workforce that is, you know, conducive to not allowing the type of sexual harassment and sexual conduct that we're seeing in a lot of this litigation. If you're able to not cooperate, or if you've determined that it's not appropriate to discipline the alleged harasser, you know, kind of discuss with the complainer why that might be. Was it a misunderstanding? Was it a personality conflict? Discuss how in the future the employees can avoid that type of conflict. Because if somebody's bringing it forward to you, even if it doesn't rise to the level of discipline or doesn't rise to the level of sexual harassment, an employee is upset and you need to take that seriously. Again, stress with that employee that any retaliation that they might feel, they need to let HR know, because that's absolutely inappropriate. And retaliation is not just termination. So, you know, a lot of times employers say, well, I didn't retaliate, the employee still works here. But retaliate can be as simple as changing somebody's work shift, moving them from an AM to a PM shift, or significantly changing their duties. And some employers will say, well, I did that to move the employee away from, you know, who the alleged harasser, who they were complaining with. That might be a reasonable option, but that absolutely has to be something that's discussed with the employee, because it can be seen as retaliatory if you are moving somebody and in the wake of their complaints or changing their duties, and that employee is then unhappy with that decision. And then, you know, just communicate with them how to move forward. So sometimes it is not as simple as just handling these complaints internally, particularly once either a charge has been filed with the EEOC or there's threatened litigation. At that point, you might need to not only conduct an internal review, but look at potentially having some external complaint handling. So the first thing you always want to do if you have either a threatened litigation or a charge or a lawsuit is notify your insurance company. If you have employment protection liability insurance, let your adjuster know so that they can handle that. And then depending on sort of the level of the alleged harasser, if they're a high-level executive or somebody that has a lot of power, do you need to notify your board of directors? Do you need to notify your CEO, your CFO? You know, keep that in mind when you're going through, when you're handling these type of allegations. Certainly, as you know, the Me Too movement has shown, you need to take public relations into account. If it's a high-level alleged harasser, you might want to have a PR firm retained to help with the considerations of how to deal with the litigation, how to deal with the alleged harasser. Certainly, no matter how high up the person is, do an immediate thorough investigation, follow your policy, and take remedial action. If your investigation shows that your CEO engaged in harassment, you need to take appropriate remedial action, the exact same action that you would have taken if it was just a coworker or a supervisor. Like I mentioned earlier, just in the last 6 months, over 400 executives have been accused of harassing. Many of those have had those allegations be founded and have lost their jobs because of it. Really important to be consistent, again, like I said, and a lot of employers now, especially with higher level executives, will have either arbitration agreements or some sort of employee agreement that requires that an employee will go through an arbitration process instead of involving a lawsuit. These are still legal for now. There are some states that have put legislation up saying that they're going to carve out arbitration agreements to not allow sexual harassment claims to go that route. So that's something you need to be aware of depending on the state that you're in. None of those have been passed yet. There's also a bill in Congress to ban employers from forcing employees to arbitrate sexual harassment. That case really has not gone, or that bill's not gone anywhere. It's pending in the House and probably will be for a long time, but it is moving through the state legislators a little bit more quickly. Certainly, if you do have any sort of settlement, you want a confidentiality provision in there. And one thing to be aware of, though, is that some states are also introducing legislation to ban confidentiality provisions. I think that that's probably not going to go anywhere, but something to be aware of. So, again, just to wrap this up, there has obviously been a huge increase of allegations of sexual harassment coming to light in the wake of Harvey Weinstein. The effect of his company is, you know, they attempted to sell the Weinstein company. In February, the Attorney General filed for civil penalties. They've now also filed criminal allegations against him. So huge repercussions. Charlie Rose was fired after the allegations came forth about him at PBS. Steve Wynn, again, a huge name, now has a tainted brand, a huge Las Vegas hotel and casino empire that he's now had to resign as the head of the hotel. An American Apparel had allegations against their CEO come out that resulted in bankruptcy filing. So I think the reality to think about this is, you know, certainly as employers, you are always aware of the cost to your employees, the potential litigation costs, the disruption to business. But really what you want to think about is, you know, if you hear a quote from somebody, or if you have an employee come say, you know, this is what was said to me, how would you feel if that was your spouse or your child? You need to really kind of personalize it and understand from the employee why they can legitimately be upset about that type of conduct. And again, you know, if, you know, think about it from Harvey Weinstein, if what was said was put on the front of the paper, you know, how would you feel about that? And that's really the reality that everybody needs to think about in the wake of the Me Too movement. So thank you, everybody, for your time, and hopefully this was helpful.